WML News at 7. Good morning. I'm Heather Curtis. Starting Monday, non-U.S. citizens will not be allowed to travel to the U.S. from South Africa and seven other countries in an effort to stop the spread of the new Omicron COVID variant. President Biden says they don't know a lot about the variant, but it seems to be highly contagious. So will your vaccine protect you from it? The World Health Organization says it may not. Vaccine makers say they're preparing.
Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson all say they should be able to produce vaccines to counter it in a matter of months. Pfizer said they've been conducting surveillance focused on monitoring for emerging variants. Moderna said it's been studying two booster candidates designed to anticipate COVID mutations, but researchers at Johns Hopkins say there just isn't that much information out yet on Omicron, and it may behave like earlier variants that weren't able to spread. Jill Nato, Fox News.
Black Friday was subdued last year because of COVID, but this year, shoppers were back. By mid-afternoon yesterday, retail sales were up about 30% from last Black Friday, according to MasterCard Spending Pulse. It tracks cash and credit card spending, but a fun day of shopping turned terrifying for some Black Friday shoppers at a mall in North Carolina.
Police say three people were shot and wounded during a fight at South Point Mall. One of the victims, a 10-year-old child, was hit when a bullet ricocheted. Thankfully, the child did not sustain life-threatening injuries.
Fox's Marianne Rafferty reports police are interviewing eyewitnesses. Some people wanted five-finger Black Friday discounts. A swarm of thieves hit up a Home Depot in Los Angeles County.
A mob of people just pulled up to the store, put their ski masks on, went inside and stole everything that they could. Employees say up to 20 people rushed the store, ranging in age from 15 to 20 years old. We're told they all came in here stealing every single crowbar, every single sledgehammer in the store. This is the latest in a series of brazen flash mob robberies in L.A.
Fox's Los Angeles's Jessica O. Yesterday, people shopped at big box stores. Today, it's time to go to Mom and Pop's for Small Business Saturday.
Main streets were hit hard by the pandemic, so small business owners are hoping people will take advantage of what they have to offer. Maryland Comptroller Peter Franco.
I can't emphasize enough how important this Small Business Saturday is. It's a big, big event, and we see it in the tax revenues.
Shutdowns left many in the D.C. area with more in their pockets because they didn't spend money on driving, going out to eat, or entertainment. Franco hopes you'll spend it today at mom and pop shops. Rachel Sutherland on WMAL and WMAL.com.
It's expected to be crowded on the roads today as people drive home from their Thanksgiving trips. The worst time to travel today and tomorrow will be between 3 and 7 p.m., according to the Maryland State Highway Administration.
It is going to be hard coming back, right? But so to help with that, we're urging folks to travel off-peak. And so to limit the amount of drivers on the road with you.
Spokesperson Sherry Christian says the best time to travel today and tomorrow will be after 9 p.m. Another good time tomorrow before 6 a.m. WMAL Sports, the Caps beat the Panthers, the Wizards beat the Thunder. Traffic and weather next. WMAL Traffic and Weather. Here's Albie D in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
Coming into D.C. on New York Avenue, there is a crash right at Montana Avenue. On 295, 395, and 695 in D.C., you shouldn't find any delays. Now in Virginia, on 395 northbound, disabled vehicle center lane is blocked approaching the GW Parkway. On the Virginia side of the Beltway, it's clear on the inner loop and on the outer loop, and on 66 in Fairfax County. No delays are reported eastbound or westbound. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Today, mostly sunny, breezy, and cool with temperatures in the mid to upper 40s. Tonight, mostly cloudy, lows in the 30s, and tomorrow, partly sunny. Warmer with temperatures in the mid to upper 50s. Right now, 34 degrees in Washington. I'm Heather Curtis on WMAL.
Now, from the WMAL WinBet Studios, the Saturday Morning Update.
And a very happy Thanksgiving weekend to you. It's hour two of the Saturday Morning Update, and that means John Gizzi joins us. He is the White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com and Newsmax TV. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rick. I'm loaded for bear today.
We're going to start with a story that you're writing on a topic that we don't typically talk to you about, and that is medicine and the new COVID-19 variant. It's the Omicron variant, but you point out something very interesting about that name.
The World Health Organization was intending to label it variant new, N-U, when it held its meeting yesterday. That, of course, is the Greek letter. But instead, they used another Greek letter, Omicron. So we now have the Omicron variant to describe the latest mutation of COVID-19. But there's a catch to it. Between nu and Omicron, there was a Greek letter that was never used. It was simply skipped. This is the letter G, XI. That's right. The Greek letter that could easily have described it, if they weren't going to call the variant nu, was the same name as the Chinese president, Xi Jinping. Now, of course, one can speculate that the WHO did want to infuriate China. Some people are offended by the terms China virus and Kung flu, and certainly if one calls this the Xi variant, it just feeds the story that the Chinese are behind the COVID virus. And, of course, evidence is very strong about that and its origin at the Wuhan lab. But there's also a history of the WHO not wanting to offend China. Last year, Hong Kong reporter Amanda Tong asked the WHO spokesman why it does not admit Taiwan into its organization when Taiwan had a stellar record of fighting COVID-19. He hung up on her. This is just another step in that pattern, it would seem, not wanting to call the variant G. I contacted the WHO about this and asked their spokesman if this was indeed true, that they did not want to offend the president of China. I haven't had a response yet.
I wonder why.
Mm-hmm.
John, in the week ahead on Wednesday, the Supreme Court takes up the Mississippi abortion law. There have been a lot of concerns about what might happen to Roe v. Wade at the Supreme Court. Give us a preview of what to expect on Wednesday.
Well, for the third time in 48 years, the highest court in the land is taking a good, hard look on whether there is a right to an abortion. Now, this was established, at least in the form of the early days of pregnancy, with the decision of Roe v. Wade back in 1973. For the most part, abortion is legal nationwide. In the Casey versus Planned Parenthood case of 1992, Roe was reviewed and Roe was upheld. And now, the court is once again looking at the Mississippi gestation law, which bans all abortions up to 15 weeks and makes no exception for rape or incest. Needless to say, this is a case that the whole world will be watching, and one is sure to see demonstrations out in front of the Supreme Court building. The administration has already filed a friend of the court brief saying that the court needs to uphold Roe v. Wade, that there is a right to an abortion that people have grown up with in the last near half century. 22 states and the District of Columbia have filed similar amicus curiae briefs. Speaking for the state of Mississippi is its Attorney General, Lynn Fitch, and she's got an all-female legal team behind her. She says it is egregious to say there is any right to an abortion, and she intends to prove it while standing up for her state's law. It's going to be a major case and one everyone will be talking about before the week is out.
You wrote a story this week that was kind of a shocker for me. You have a well-entrenched congressman from Texas who decides to give up his seat to run for attorney general. Not only is that strange, but the reason why is even more strange.
You're talking about Louis Gohmert, 18-year congressman with a safe seat, a stalwart defender of former President Trump, and a good-as-Goldwater conservative. He could have that seat for life, but at age 68, Louis Gohmert said He's leaving Congress to run for Attorney General of Texas. Now, sources close to the congressman say that this unusual move is coming about for an unusual reason. He doesn't want George P. Bush to win the all-important Republican primary to be the Lone Star State's legal eagle. George P. Bush, of course, is the namesake nephew and grandson of two former presidents. He is the heir to the Bush dynasty, and his election as Attorney General would almost certainly propel him to the governorship, the Senate, or something else in a few years. Now, there is an incumbent Attorney General, Ken Paxton. Gohmert reportedly considers him tainted because of numerous scandals against him involving his staff, as well as stock speculation he made before becoming AG. In any event, under Texas law, all candidates compete on the same ballot in a primary, and if no one gets a majority, the top two vote-getters square off in a runoff. Clearly, Louis Gohmert is hoping it will be him versus George P. Bush, and he can finally finish off the dynastic order.
So that's political intrigue in Texas. Let's go with some little international intrigue with Interpol.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the way to describe it, Rick. International intrigue. Interpol, the global policing agency that is 95 years old, just elected a new president. He is Ahmed Nasser al-Raisi, Inspector General of Egypt's Ministry of the Interior. He took office, and within a matter of days, Raisi was charged by various sources with torture while he was at the Ministry of the Interior. He denies the charges, but Matthew Hedges, a British academic, went to the Wall Street Journal and other publications saying he was held and he has evidence of torture. It'll be interesting to see how the United States feels about this. Remember, the U.S. is a member going back to the 1920s of Interpol. It was only 3 years ago when Vladimir Putin's candidate looked like he would be elected that the U.S. got out very publicly behind a South Korean police chief who defeated the Putin candidate to take over Interpol. In 1937, if one wants to go back, the very controversial chief of detectives in Berlin, Arthur Nebbe, a close ally of Adolf Hitler, was elected president of Interpol. The U.S. withdrew for 4 years as he was followed by a succession of German candidates. In any event, the U.S. is very serious about Interpol and who leads it, and it will be interesting in the days ahead to see what they have to say about General Raisi. We'll keep you posted.
National Press Club, Tuesday morning. Could there be some light shed on the potential future of Mike Pence? And you will be there.
I certainly will be there. Mike Pence has been relatively quiet since he left the vice presidency. There is strong speculation he and Donald Trump will clash over politics in the midterm election, leaving out who runs in 2024. But for now, he will be speaking at the press club about the abortion case in Mississippi that we discussed earlier. Clearly, that's important, and it's an issue that's near and dear to the former vice president's heart. But anyone knows that any reporters covering him that day are going to be asking, what about 2024 and your own plans, Mr. Pence? I'll be one of them.
We'll watch for your tweets on Tuesday night. John Gizzi, the White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. John, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure and never boring out there in the world today. Stay safe.
Thank you, John. It's 7:18, Saturday morning update, WMAL. We'll talk with Jim Trusty once again next. We're going to talk to him about the smash and grabs going on around the country. What can we do about it, and what is the cause? That's next. But first, Al BD's in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
Here's the latest traffic update that I have for you. On the Maryland side of the Beltway, I just checked out the cameras. You're clear on the inner loop and on the outer loop. Nothing in the roadway to slow you down in Prince George's County and in Montgomery County. In Prince George's County, between the two beltways, on the VW Parkway and on 95, you're at speed northbound and southbound. On Route 50 in Prince George's County, between the Beltway and the Bay Bridge, no delays on the eastbound side and on the westbound side. And now, from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL StormWatch 7 forecast.
Mostly sunny, breezy, and cool on this Saturday. High temperatures into the mid and upper 40s, so a chilly start to the weekend. Later on tonight, mostly cloudy skies, lows back in the 30s across the region. As we head towards your Sunday, partly sunny, it will be warmer. Temperatures back into the mid and upper 50s. Have a little disturbance rolling through Sunday evening. Not really expecting anything as far as precipitation from it, but yes, breezy winds will be back as we get towards Monday of next week. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the StormWatch 7 Weather Center.
34 degrees in the nation's capital, 720 on the Saturday morning update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
The Saturday morning update continues. I'm Rick Fowler. We spoke earlier with Jim Trusty about the Ahmaud Arbery trial and verdict in Brunswick, Georgia. We turn to some other stories on the legal front this week. Jim is a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington and the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Yesterday was Black Friday, but last weekend it was Smash and Grab Saturday for all of your shopping in cities in California, and we've seen that happening again on Wednesday this week. Why are we seeing this sort of new trend toward up to 80 people just smashing out windows and taking anything they want and driving off?
Well, first of all, Rick, don't worry. Three of them have been charged. So we only have 77 that have not been charged at this point. But look, I think it's a two-step process. One is that the legislature in California changed the threshold between misdemeanor and felony to something, I think, at about $950. So anything under $950, or maybe it's under $1,000, is considered a misdemeanor. So the general risk associated with this kind of conduct went down. But the second part of it, and I think maybe the more important part, is that the district attorney, Chesa Boudin, who is, by all accounts, essentially a public defender running the district attorney's office, he came in and essentially announced that he's just not going to waste his time on these property offenses, and that he effectively, despite taking an oath of office, decriminalized misdemeanor shoplifting. And although some of these crimes have graduated into other things when they fight with security personnel, for instance, but he's basically let the message go out that under his culture at the DA's office, this is a freebie. And people catch on to that, and they realize that there's not going to be much cost and a lot of benefit, and they take advantage of it.
From your experience at DOJ, when you have 80 perpetrators and you have three of them, what is the likelihood that those three are going to rat out the others? Or if they're in a situation where it's only a misdemeanor, I guess it's safer to keep your mouth shut and not rat out those guys.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of leverage on a misdemeanor count to get people to talk about other people, because, you know, they pretty much realize the stakes aren't all that high. I think there's another dynamic here, which is if this was essentially a social media-driven event, which I have to think it was, that they had some way of contacting each other over social media, three of them might not know more than another three or four. You know, I doubt that there's any one person that can name all 80 people that participated. So, again, I wouldn't hold my breath if they get up to a real high number of that 80 getting prosecuted.
Well, it sounds like the issues in the major cities are sort of multi-pronged. In other words, in that one, you've got the law that was basically watered down. Then you have the prosecutors that are basically watering down their prosecutions. And then you have the watering down of the bail system. And as an example, we saw with Daryl Brooks, a rap sheet is more like a novel. And you saw what happened in Waukesha, Wisconsin, when he mowed down and killed six people and injured 40 plus others.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be horror stories around the country when you have what I would call essentially blind bail reform. You know, bail is not something that was designed to be a class system that incarcerates the poor. In fact, bail is an alternative to jail. The whole purpose is if we can assure that people will show up in court and they're not an undue risk to the community, let's let them put a little bit of money in the pot, a little incentive to show up when they're supposed to show up. So I actually think the whole fundamentals are wrong when it comes to talking about bail reform. Now, I'll admit, there's going to be circumstances where somebody without any money gets locked up in an overcrowded system and spends maybe more time in jail than the offense even carries, right? It could be a disorderly conduct case, and they get locked up for 90 days on a 60-day charge. That's the kind of thing that needs fixing. I get that. I think there should be ways of addressing that with pretrial services, you know, electronic monitoring, expedited court dates. I mean, there are solutions to that problem that don't kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater. And the bail reform issues that we're seeing in places like New York include not letting a judge even have discretion to set a bail amount in cases like assault and stalking and even some forms of arson. So if you're trying to pretend to the general public that this is all about just nonviolent offenders and this problem of essentially classism, you're missing the mark with some of the bail reforms that I've seen around the country. You look at what happened in Wisconsin with Daryl Brooks, Rick. It's just a maddening situation. You said the guy had a long record, including crimes of violence. His pending case in 2020 involved an allegation of shooting a firearm at his nephew while being a felon in possession of that firearm. And his bail went from $10,000 to $7,500 to $500, which he posted in early 2021. The next case, the one most recently to the events in Waukesha, included basically trying to run over a woman with that same car, obstructing an officer, and felony bail jumping. I mean, this guy is ringing every bell for both risk of flight and danger to the community. So I don't really care too much what any assistant district attorney says about bail in front of that judge. It's malpractice from the judge and from the prosecutor to agree to something like a $1,000 cash bail for this guy. It is literally a no-brainer that he should have never been on the streets to commit a crime that Rick reminds me of the terrorist attack in Lyon, France. I mean, you know, we've got six dead, 48 injured. We have, I think, about 17 children, 18 in the beginning, that were sent to a children's hospital. I mean, this is a horrific event that didn't have to happen.
Well, Jim, we've seen New York basically going down the tubes under Mayor de Blasio. The crime rates are up. It's a mess in New York. But the newly elected mayor, Eric Adams, has been a law and order advocate. He actually appoints some of the judges in New York City. Do you think there ultimately could be some improvement, not only with the mayor's support of the police, but now in the judicial system?
I think it's going to be incremental. I certainly appreciate where he's coming from. I think he's looked at the de Blasio model and realized he's got to turn, you know, 180 degrees away from some of the things de Blasio had in place. What he has the ability to do is to put essentially magistrates or low-level judges that deal with the question of bail, not to be insulting, but they're not the full trial judges. But he gets to put them in place, and they'll be the ones that make those initial determinations. The problem is, if you get down to it, they're still going to be looking at these bail reform laws and being handcuffed. They may have better instincts. They may take cases on the margin and make better decisions, but they're still going to be limited in terms of which cases are even eligible for any sort of conditions of release. And that's where I think the problem is, because if a guy gets locked up by one of these new tougher on crime magistrates, then he's going to be able to appeal it eventually and say, hey, this broke our bail reform law to even have me post any sort of bail. And so I don't think you're going to see an immediate widespread change, although the philosophical change is probably welcome and helpful on at least some incremental level.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington, thanks as always for your expertise, and enjoy Small Business Saturday, Jim.
All right, sure. Thanks. Have a good weekend.
You bet, and you too. It's 7:28, Saturday Morning Update, WMAL. Coming up, we'll talk with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer and K.T. McFarland. Vladimir Putin is ratcheting things up on the Ukraine border, and the Chinese are telling our congressmen and women where they can go and where they can't go. That's all on the way.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. The one radio station for you to depend on. All day, every day. 105.9 FM, WMAL. A Cumulus Media station. News now.
WMAL News at 7:30. Good morning, I'm Heather Curtis. The U.S. is joining dozens of other countries restricting travel from Southern Africa to stop the spread of the new Omicron COVID variant.
President Biden says he's acting with caution by barring travel of foreign nationals from South Africa and other countries in the region.
We don't know a lot about the variant except that it is a great concern. It seems to spread rapidly.
The president says it's further evidence to get vaccinated if you're not.
Everyone eligible for the booster shot should get the booster shot immediately upon being eligible.
And President Biden is urging nations meeting at the World Trade Organization to waive intellectual property protections for COVID vaccines. Jared Halpern, Fox News.
If you're driving home from your Thanksgiving trip this weekend, expect to be stuck in traffic. If you want to beat the rush, the best times to travel will be after 9 p.m. today and tomorrow, and before 6 a.m. tomorrow, according to Maryland State Highway Administration spokesperson Sherry Christian.
If you want to check road conditions before you leave, head to roads.maryland.gov, and you can find out the conditions of wherever you want to go.
She says the worst times to travel will be today and tomorrow between 3 and 7 p.m. Retailers got what they wanted for Christmas yesterday, a bump in Black Friday sales. By mid-afternoon yesterday, retail sales were up about 30% compared to last Black Friday, when shoppers stayed away from stores because of COVID. The number comes from MasterCard Spending Pulse, which tracks all kinds of payments. WMAL Sports, the Caps beat the Panthers and the Wizards beat the Thunder. Traffic and weather next. WMAL traffic, here's Albie D in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
Right now on the Virginia side of the Beltway, after looking in the traffic cameras, I'm not seeing any construction and I have no reports of any delays. You should be at the speed limit. On 66 in Fairfax County, eastbound and westbound, those lanes are clear. On 95 between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, northbound and southbound lanes have no issues. On the Maryland side of the Beltway, from Prince George's County through Montgomery County, you're not going to hit the brakes. And if you're traveling between the two Beltways on the BW Parkway and on 95 in Prince George's County, you're at speed northbound and southbound. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Today, mostly sunny, breezy, and cool with high temperatures in the mid and upper 40s. Right now, 34 degrees in Washington. I'm Heather Curtis on WMAL.
7:35 Saturday morning update, WMAL. A happy Thanksgiving weekend to you, and a happy Thanksgiving weekend to Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. He is the president of the London Center for Policy Research. Tony, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Always great to join you.
Well, both China and Russia misbehaving the holiday week. They didn't take a holiday off, that's for sure. Nope. Let's look at the Ukraine border. Russian troops amassing there. The president of Ukraine, President Zelensky, saying that he has uncovered a coup attempt that was being plotted. What is this adding up to?
So if you look at what's being said, it's very interesting that the president of Ukraine is alleging that on the 1st and 2nd of December, right around the corner, there's going to be a coup attempt that's primarily pushed by Russia. And the internal political elements are loyal to Vladimir Putin. And this is no small issue because, as you might remember, back during the Obama days, the last term of the Obama administration, there were several public attempts of influence by both sides, the Russians and the United States, on the Ukrainian path forward. As a matter of fact, the then ambassador to the EU was caught, you know, making phone calls that the Russians released, kind of showing the U.S. involvement. So this is no small issue. What's different now is the buildup, the military buildup on the border. There's no denial that at this point on three sides of the country, north, east, and south, through the Crimea especially, where the Russians have occupied that, that the Russians have a significant military force established. I mean, we're talking about 94,000 troops. That's no small number, plus 1,200 tanks. So you combine the two together, it's very clear that something may happen there. And I've talked to my colleagues who study this, and Putin is feeling very much that he's in control, and it's going to be his choice whether he decides to do this or not. And the coup attempt may be something that relates to further destabilizing Ukraine internally, even if they don't have a full successful coup, just to make it more difficult for the Ukrainian government to respond to any continued Russian provocation or land grab. my colleagues and I believe it's probably, if Putin's going to do this, it's probably going to do it actually in the winter, and maybe as soon as January. And, Rick, this is part of a larger pattern of where the Russians don't see, they don't have any real fear of any pushback from the United States. And NATO's been fairly sedate on this as well. So without any strong messaging or any strong action, I think there's a good chance Putin may do something.
You led me into my next question, and that is, yeah, what would NATO nations do in response, or does he have leverage on them because of the energy, the gas and oil?
Well, he does. Now, that's the other issue. We've warned people for years, NATO especially. I met with members of NATO in the UK years ago saying, no, this whole idea of allowing Central Europe to be dependent on Putin during the winter may result in something really dangerous. And I think that we're at that point where you're going to have NATO nations. Now, remember, Ukraine is not a member of NATO. They did apply, but they're not NATO. So there's no Title V, Article V obligation to respond if they're attacked. With that said, NATO and the United States have always said that they would respond to aggression. And I think we, the United States, do have a treaty with them that was done in Dayton, Ohio, back in the 90s, that said basically that we, you know, if the Ukrainians gave up their nukes, we would come to their aid. So that's going to be tested. And again, while Biden is saying, oh, we're considering returning to providing weapons to Ukraine, if Russia invades in January, those weapons are never going to get there, and you're going to be faced with a real no-nonsense response. You got to do something to show either you're going to obligate yourself to support the Ukrainians based on the treaty, or you're just going to give it up and let Putin run the board. And that's what, at this point, I think Putin's counting on the latter.
I want to turn to China because it's a similar situation. We had a delegation of lawmakers who were headed in that direction. They decided to stop in Taiwan over Thanksgiving. The Chinese were very upset about it, and they said it was a mistake for the congressmen and women to do that. I'm not sure why the Chinese government can push our congressmen and women around, but they did, or tried to.
And the other thing that has upset the People's Republic of China, the PRC or the CCP, is that the Biden administration did invite Taiwan to a virtual session of democracies on 9-10 December. And obviously China said that's another quote-unquote provocative action. And it's interesting that there's been very little comment or commentary on this by the Biden administration. Again, there's been no significant pushing back saying, no, this is a red line for us too. It's been kind of milquetoast. And so that's where a similar thing has been faced with the Chinese, with the PRC. Again, we're talking about two separate Chinas because Taiwan considers itself the Republic of China. And so the Republic of China is a democracy. And they are the ones who say that they're the actual China, even though they're technically on an island. And obviously the communists, the People's Republic of China, is the one that says that, no, they're the China. So this is where the United States has had this bifurcated policy, which I don't think has ever served us well, going through multiple administrations. No administration, in my judgment, has ever gotten this right. And the more we've kowtowed to the PRC, the more aggressive they become, and now it's to the point of where I think they have significant military capacity to do something in this regard should they decide to do something against Taiwan.
More of a whiter shade of pink these days when you talk about red lines. Wanted to ask you also about Taiwan, and if there were to be a Chinese takeover, if they were to attempt to take over Taiwan, what would that look like militarily?
That's a great question, because one of the things China would want to do is preserve as much of the industrial capacity of Taiwan as they can. Remember, Rick, when we see electronics, we have all sorts of stuff coming out of Taiwan. Taiwan, the Republic of China, is one of the largest producers of chips. As a matter of fact, part of the problem we've seen here in the United States lately is the car shortage based on not getting modules. Well, the reason those modules that are missing are normally made in Taiwan. So the first thing that would happen if China attempted a full-blown military invasion of Taiwan would be basically a catastrophic failure of the global economy. This would go all around very fast. Now, the Chinese may be counting on being able to recoup profits that they would lose through an invasion by having the industrial capacity of Taiwan added to its own industrial capacity. And I think that's what they would be thinking. But to get there, it would be very difficult. So this is one of those things where I think the Chinese want. It's far more a desire than a capacity at this point, because like we're seeing right now in Ukraine, like we just talked about, we're seeing massive movement of troops, material, aircraft, things like that. The Chinese would have to do the same thing, Rick, over a very wide sea lane to go, you know, via the ocean. And so those sea barges or landing craft, whatever you want to call them, would have to be created, prepared, and stocked. And so this is where the Chinese are not there yet. We would see that coming. But, again, with the continued less than vigorous defense of our allies by the Biden administration, again, we'll continue to see them be more provocative. And, again, this is one of those things where they may do something, the Chinese, at the same time the Russians do something, to try to swamp our ability to respond, because the United States would barely be able to respond to one of the two, to respond to two peer-to-peer conflicts. That puts us back in World War II level manning and capacity regarding our military forces, and we couldn't get there in a year. It would take us two, and by then the war would be over. So it's a very difficult strategic situation we find ourselves in, because lo and behold, I think our military is pretty much woke right now, and they're more focused on minorities and percentages than having the capacity to fight a war and win it should we have to.
Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, the host of the Thought to Action podcast. If you have a little time on your hands this weekend because you had part of the week off, might be a good opportunity to check it out. Tony, what's on the agenda?
So we're talking more about gun rights and rights to respond to provocation yourself and the individual level, things about the Rittenhouse verdict and being able to kind of walk through and figure out what your rights are and how to properly defend yourself and be prepared to defend yourself. So from micro to macro, we'll be talking about the individual rights this coming week.
Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, London Center for Policy Research. You'll find it all at londoncenter.org. Tony, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Rick.
You bet. 7:45 Saturday morning update on WMAO. We'll talk with KT McFarland next, but first Al BD's in the WMAO Traffic Center.
On the Maryland side of the Beltway, from Prince George's County through Montgomery County, bridge to bridge, inner loop and outer loop, you're at the posted speed limit. If you're traveling between the two beltways on the BW Parkway and on 95, no delays on the northbound side or on the southbound side. In Prince George's County on Route 50, between the Beltway and the Bay Bridge, eastbound and westbound lanes are clear. At the Bay Bridge, two lanes are headed east and three lanes are coming west with no delays on either shoreline. And in Montgomery County on 270 between the Beltway and Frederick, you're at speed northbound and southbound. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Mostly sunny, breezy, and cool on this Saturday. High temperatures into the mid and upper 40s, so a chilly start to the weekend. Later on tonight, mostly cloudy skies, lows back in the 30s across the region. As we head towards your Sunday, partly sunny, it will be warmer. Temperatures back into the mid and upper 50s. Have a little disturbance rolling through Sunday evening. Not really expecting anything as far as precipitation from it, but yes, breezy winds will be back as we get towards Monday of next week. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
34 degrees, 7:47 on the Saturday morning update. 7:49, it's the Saturday morning update on WMAO for Thanksgiving weekend. We are joined by KT McFarland, President Trump's first Deputy National Security Advisor. She is the author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People, a look behind the scenes at the White House. KT, good morning and happy Thanksgiving weekend to you.
Well, happy Thanksgiving weekend to you and Merry Christmas.
We were talking with Tony Schaefer a couple of minutes ago about the military crises facing the Biden administration, China-Ukraine issues. We look domestically, we see inflation, we see the gasoline prices, we see COVID-19, we see all these crises facing the White House. You've been in the White House in that role as the Deputy National Security Advisor. What's going on in the White House? What's the sort of the scene there?
Well, they ought to be in full-blown panic. They're probably not. Look, the one constant rule in the White House is that when crises happen, They tend to happen all at once. Things go from great to catastrophe very quickly. And one reason for that is that they feed on each other, especially in foreign affairs. But there's another constant rule that I've observed for all the years I've been in the White House and in different Republican administrations, is that the consequence of failure is usually not felt immediately. It's like a boomerang. It comes back to hit you much harder, and it comes back when you least expect it and from the direction in which you least expect it. And because they feed on each other, too, especially economic and domestic affairs. I mean, I look ahead. What does 2022 promise? It is not going to be a good year for the White House, for Democrats, and especially not for America.
Well, you know, it's just this feeling of absolute and total incompetence at the White House. I mean, we saw the Secretary of Energy the other day at a press briefing about the release of 50 million barrels of oil, the Band-Aid the Biden administration wants to put on the gasoline price crises. And she doesn't even know how many barrels of oil we consume in a day.
Look, on the economic front, inflation is going to rise. In some cases, it'll go well into the double digits. And you know, for example, Thanksgiving turkey costs 20% more than last year. Gasoline prices are going to rise, especially as we get into the winter months, and more forecasters predict a very cold and snowy winter. Unemployment's going to rise at the same time, but in the meantime, jobs are going unfilled. You can't, I read something today, you can't get a Santa Claus to work in a department store because nobody wants the job. Well, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that if you pay people not to work, they're not going to work. Any dope could have figured this out. So I've got to think, maybe what the tone-deaf people in the White House and the Washington bubble want, they want high gas prices because they think, well, it'll force people to take public transport or get electric cars. And they think, well, inflation, that's actually not a bad thing because it's going to cause employers to raise wages. And higher food prices, well, especially for meat, that's okay if you don't eat meat. You know, it's like Washington is immune to what's happening around the country with the gas prices, the inflation, and the way, especially in inflation in the supermarkets. And on foreign affairs, I mean, it's going to get just as bad, if not worse. Look, Russia is threatening to attack Ukraine. Ukraine is not a NATO member, so we don't have to come to their military assistance, but it would be a real slap to the Western world, especially to the United States, if Ukraine buckles to Russia. And Russia's even making noises on the Baltic countries. That's Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. They are NATO members, and so if Russia makes any kind of military move or quasi-military move, what does that mean for the NATO alliance? Do we have a war in the Baltics? Now, at the same time, China wants Taiwan. They now want it sooner rather than later, but they don't want to go to war for it. They figure enough economic and political provocation against Taiwan, Taiwan's going to bow to the inevitable and join China rather than risk war and certain destruction. I mean, China plays a long game. They don't mind destroying Taiwan. The people of Taiwan, they might feel differently if it had to come to that. And I must say, as an interesting aside, Biden is taking a pretty tough political stand with Taiwan. He's invited them to a democracy conference. He's meeting with Taiwan officials. That's all well and good, but what he should be doing is a full-bore economic and technology press against China, starting with pushing manufacturing semiconductors in the U.S. rather than in Taiwan. And frankly, he's likely to go in the other direction economically. He's likely to lift sanctions against China to ease his supply chain crisis rather than fix it by manufacturing critical goods in the U.S. So we're going to be even more dependent upon China for our critical needs for manufacturing. You know, so if you take it a step further, Biden a couple of months ago was promising America's back. Mostly he's back. But America's back. I mean, the Russians and the Chinese, they're going to laugh at that joke for years because they're moving to expand and reclaim what they see as their rightful historic lands, and the United States and this particular administration are so dysfunctional, they'll probably let it happen.
So we've painted kind of a bleak picture in the last 5 minutes or so. But
yeah.
Last weekend, you gave us a preview of an opinion piece that was published at FoxNews.com this week, and the title, "This Thanksgiving, I'm Thankful for Democracy and the Common Sense of Ordinary Americans." And for somebody that has not seen that, FoxNews.com, you should see the opinion piece. And KT, we painted that bleak picture, but as you point out in the opinion piece, there is hope as we look at 2022.
Oh, yeah. You know, there's hope for the country. Look, it's going to be a bad year for Democrats and people in the White House and probably America, but the good news is that American people are starting to fight back. I mean, we went into lockdown, COVID lockdown, nearly 2 years ago. We've emerged to find a greatly changed country. Wokeism has infected the schools and the churches and the media and the corporations. Teachers indoctrinate children with racial hatred and anti-Americanism, all under the guise of being fair and equitable and blah, blah. Freedom of speech being banned from college campuses and dorms and faculty lounges, and our most renowned media outlets, they routinely and proudly censor any voices that criticize the radical left socialist agenda. Some of our greatest cities are defunding police departments. You know, American people aren't nuts. And how many of you have had conversations in recent weeks and months with friends who look around a room and kind of whisper fearfully, what's happened to America? I think the silent majority of Americans realize we're going in a very bad direction economically, foreign policy, and culturally. They're just not sure what to do about it. But in the last couple of weeks, there's been a shift. People are starting to say, I've had enough. I've had enough. I'm going to stand up to the socialist, totalitarian, racist, anti-American agenda, even if they come after me. But the battlegrounds are not in Washington. They're in the local school boards and the town halls and the state capitals. And the patriots, the heroes, the warriors, they're not the guys in the woke military or the FBI or the Injustice Department. They're average Americans. They live ordinary lives. And here's why I'm really confident is that, you know, most Americans, we're so busy with our lives, with our jobs, our kids, our families, that we don't get really political. But when we do, we then are a force to be reckoned with. So who are these patriots? Well, how about the judge and the defense attorneys and the jurors in Kenosha, Wisconsin, who ensured that Kyle Rittenhouse got a fair trial, despite receiving death threats to the judge, his attorneys, and the jurors? Those people put their lives on the line to give that guy a fair trial. And what about the businessman turned candidate, Glenn Youngkin? He won a historic victory in Virginia by focusing on what voters care about, their kids' education, their communities. And with a truck driver who decided to challenge one of the most entrenched, corrupt politicians in New Jersey, and he beat him without even spending any money. Or the Justice Department Inspector General, he's warned now that the FBI and Department of Justice have become too politicized, and the American people are losing confidence. They think there's a two-tier system of justice. I mean, more and more examples of this are piling up. The Wall Street Journal, 2 days ago, they ran their historic Thanksgiving editorial where they describe what's the origins of Thanksgiving. They've been running it for, I don't know, close to a century. And yet the woke left came after that and them and said, you can't run that because it's anti-American and it's racist and anti-Native Americans. And the Wall Street Journal said, no, we're going to run it anyway. And the public opinion polls support it more than anything. I mean, you see it there. The socialist agenda is collapsing. I mean, who's watching MSNBC, CNN, New York Times, Washington Post? New York Times, only the recipe section is gaining readership. And CNN and MSNBC, they're now so far in the dumps that they're kind of only people watching them are inside the Beltway, maybe a few factors on the Upper and East Side of Manhattan, maybe some people in California, and the immediate friends and family of the people who work there. Other than that, nobody's watching them. So I think we're slow to rile up, but I think we're riled. So as bad as it's going to be for 2022, for the Democrats and the White House and the woke world, I think it's going to be a great year for democracy. Because
KT McFarland, the author of... I'm sorry, KT, go ahead.
No, I think we're going to do it. I think it's great.
KT McFarland, the author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People, her opinion piece. That's why I'm thankful for democracy at foxnews.com. Enjoy the rest of the weekend, KT. Thank you so much.
Pleasure and an honor.
Ours as well. And that's it for the Saturday morning update on WMAL. Garden Sense follows the 8 o'clock news.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. The one radio station for you to depend on. All day, every day. 105.9 FM, WMAL. A Cumulus Media station.